This week on The Right Side, the NDP rules out amalgamation in Victoria despite local support. The media overcovers Alberta MLA Derek Fildebrandt leaving the UCP, 3,800 illegal migrants in August already, and a lack of immigrant integration, and the meltdown at the Rebel. What's true? What isn't? This is The Right Side, episode 30, recorded Saturday, August 19th, 2017. The Right Absorptive Capacity. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. This week, Patrick and I are back this week, as we are each and every week.
Yeah, we're up into episode 30 now. I mean, that's quite a good accomplishment, isn't it?
Indeed, and we do have quite the episode 30 in store here for what has been a rather interesting and really bizarre news week in terms of everything that could have potentially happened. So we got lots of, I think we could say, weird things to talk about. We'll start off with, of course, the most normal, which is probably in BC. And what we're going to do with these stories is cut out some bias and sensationalism that the mainstream media just enjoys inserting into the news. Because let's face it, this week is definitely a prime example of why we're here. So.
Exactly. And it's certainly a good thing that we did our NDP special last week, because we certainly wouldn't be able to do it this week with how much has been going on. And so let's start off with BC. And it's really been a busy week this week for the new BC NDP government. They've announced plans to raise the minimum wage to $15 by 2021, which you might remember echoes some promises from Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne. And Alberta as well. Small business owners have criticized the move, not surprisingly, saying that it will severely negatively impact their business and the economy. And the NDP have also released a report on ICBC, which is the province's crown corporation, which was originally supposed to provide universal and affordable auto insurance. However, Attorney General David Eby describes ICBC as being on the path to insolvency, which insolvency is being unable to pay off your debts. Internal reports say this would require at least a doubling of rates. And for myself, as a car driver of over 10 years now, I already have paid over $1,100 for the year of 2017 back in January, and I'm certainly not looking forward to that going up if it does. However, there's something even more harmful for the economy than unsustainable minimum wage increases and higher auto insurance rates in the short term, and that is, of course, a bloated civil service that requires taxpayers to pay way more in taxes every year than they should. So according to an article in the Times Colonist, the new NDP provincial government has no immediate plans to consider amalgamating the Greater Victoria Capital Region's 13 municipalities, but will, quote, imminently release a report that could result in more integrated services. So Municipal Affairs Minister Selena Robinson said she will share the report with mayors and then the public. So what Greater Victoria municipalities choose to do with it is up to them, she said. Quote, local governments are more responsible for making choices about how they want to deliver services and the governance issues that come along with that. They're obligated to represent the best interests of their constituents, and it's really up to the local governments to decide how to do that. I'm hopeful that this report will help them with that. End quote. So what Robinson doesn't really seem to realize here is that under the Constitution Act, Section 92, municipal governments and other, quote, local affairs are of the exclusive jurisdiction of the provincial governments. So it actually is the provincial government's responsibility to act on amalgamation. And you might remember back in 1998 when Toronto was amalgamated, it was the Progressive Conservative provincial government that was led by Mike Harris that created legislation for that to happen, which was actually in spite of municipal government opposition. And integrating services is just one of a string of regional issues that the new NDP government has said it will leave up to local authorities to act on. Last week, Robinson said she won't wade into this dysfunctional Nanaimo Council's turmoil. We haven't gone over that on this show, but basically the council has a lot of infighting, and it's not getting any work done, and it's really making municipal politics up there look really bad. And Solicitor General Mike Farnworth has said that he didn't have any plans to amalgamate Greater Victoria's police departments, which is causing a lot of problems with jurisdiction issues, shared services issues, and just the increased amount of policing that has to be done over the smaller areas. So really, when you think about it, the problem with leaving amalgamation up to municipal governments to deal with is that they will usually never carry through with it on their own, as it would lead to a reduction of not just mayors and councillors, but civil servants as well. And the NDP government leaving it up for them to decide if they'll keep their job is kind of just as bad as the letting the politicians set their own wages, which have happened in the past as well. Furthermore, the idea of studying some form of amalgamation was already put to the electorate in 8 of the 13 municipalities in the November 2014 municipal election. 75% of voters supported the idea, and the amalgamation questions differed in each municipality, with 5 supporting a study or analysis of the benefits of amalgamation, and the other 3 outright asking for yes or no on the topic. The only municipality of the 8 to not have a majority voting in favor for some form of amalgamation was Oak Bay, which, of course, is the richest municipality with a strong independent identity. So in the wake of the vote, the BC Liberal government said it would do a governance study and provide staff and resources to communities interested in looking at amalgamation. And in 2015, then Premier Christy Clark's mandate letter to Community Minister Peter Fassbender instructed him to develop and present options to cabinet on potential processes under which local governments could either amalgamate or integrate service delivery by June 30th, 2016. So after this, former Liberal Cabinet Minister George Abbott's company Circle Square Consulting and Urban Systems, they won a 2016 bid to work with the 13 capital regional governments to explore ways to integrate services and governance, but not specifically amalgamation. The $95,000 report is expected to identify the integrated services that already exist, suggest what else could be done, and to chart a potential path forward. It's almost 1 year behind in its expected release, however. But despite the buzz around it, the topic of amalgamation was conspicuously absent from the mandate letter that Premier John Horgan issued to Robinson on July 24th. And an earlier article by the Times columnist asks a very important question: what's the price of democracy? So Greater Victoria property taxpayers paid just a total of just over $2 million in salary and expenses for the 91 part-time mayors and councillors in the region's 13 municipalities. The figure is more than double of the $826,000 which is paid for the 9-member council in Surrey, just over on the mainland, which, with a population of 403,000, is larger than Greater Victoria, which is a population of 367,000. The quote from former Victoria councillor Shelley Gudgeon, who is now the newly elected chair of Amalgamation Yes, says that, quote, "If you were to compare the municipalities of the CRD and Surrey, you would see that they are far more efficient in the delivery of services." And she says that her concern with the organization is not necessarily with the 91 elected officials, but with the 13 separate bureaucracies that support them. She said that's where tens of millions of dollars are being wasted. Salaries of elected officials are just a drop in the bucket when it comes to municipal spending. And for example, the combined salaries of Greater Victoria's 13 top municipal managers alone in 2016 was more than $2 million. So at the end of the day, with all of this money being wasted on unnecessary civil service, having 91 mayors and councillors, and with most of the municipalities polled on the issue in favor, the question remains, why is the NDP government stalling on this issue?
That is indeed a very good question, because according to my geography, the vast majority of the NDP caucus and cabinet either comes from the island or the greater Vancouver area. And if they come from the island, this might be more of an issue towards them. But if there is just – it doesn't seem to be any mention of it all in the mandate letters, as you're saying, that definitely raises some eyebrows. Was it at all talked about in the previous election this year?
No, it was not talked about whatsoever. A lot of the issues were either Vancouver-based or the province as a whole. The island wasn't really talked about that much, but with the premier's seat being held in Langford, just to the west here, and with Andrew Weaver's seat being in Oak Bay, I would think it's certainly it certainly should be of some concern to them, because this is their home turf, is Victoria. And with Green Party, the three seats coming in the Victoria or just north of Victoria region, and with most of the NDP strongholds being held here as well, I would think this is something that they'd want to have a look at. And given that a lot of people are in favor of this, there should be at least some ball that's rolling on this issue. And the fact that they've cut it off completely, it raises some eyebrows, I think.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And, I mean, like you said here in this second last bullet point, the 13 top municipal managers alone, their salaries were worth more than $2 million. Now, when you start adding all these up and you start thinking about amalgamation, that's some serious money to be saved that could be spent on other projects at the municipal level. And I know here, from the Edmonton perspective, the city government is always looking for extra money that they can spend on their projects. So a little bit of housekeeping and tidying of this to save money would go a long way in the future. But it's like you say, it's very interesting that the NDP is not looking at this.
Mm-hmm. And just think, there's 91 elected officials in the Greater Victoria region for just 367,000 people, when normally you'd only have a 9-member council for that same amount.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's 10 times as much is just crazy.
That's roughly 4,000 people for each elected member.
Yeah. Now, the article did mention that most of those councillors are part-time, but the fact remains is that really, when it comes to something like municipal government, we should be having full-time people in there who know what they're doing and are able to get things done, not part-timers who are having to concern themselves with other jobs just to make ends meet.
Indeed. All right, well, we'll definitely have to watch and see where this is going, because it definitely is something that wasn't touched on in the election, and the fact that there is no mandate here, but the municipalities seem as though they would want this to happen kind of raises some eyebrows. So we're going to continue raising the eyebrows right now, except we're going to do that in Alberta. And this week, we mentioned in the previous episode that former Wild Rose member Derek Fildebrandt was facing some financial issues. That continued on this week and ultimately ended up with the Strathmore Brooks MLA stepping down from the UCP caucus on Tuesday night. He is still an MLA sitting as an independent. Interim UCP leader Nathan Cooper has said that Fildebrandt will remain where he is for the time being, but did not rule out a path for him to return to the UCP caucus once the issues have been resolved. And you might be wondering from last week what these issues are. Well, these issues start, of course, with the Airbnb rental of his taxpayer-funded Edmonton apartment, which raises questions for all of government, naturally. But there were a few other issues this past week. Just a couple numbers before we move on to that. Between January and March of this year, Fildebrandt claimed $7,720 on accommodation, but he also rented the apartment at 8 different Airbnb clients for a total of $2,555. And once this came out, he did pay back the money to the provincial treasury, where it will go towards paying down the provincial debt. But this past Monday, it was also revealed that Derek Fildebrandt claimed erroneously for restaurant expenses and a daily meal allowance 5 times over the last 2.5 years. The total price for these double dipping meal expenses was $192.60, $192.60 over 2.5 years for 5 meal expenses.
So, which is not very much at all.
Exactly. Compared to the multiple thousands of dollars we had during the Allison Redford expense scandals or various other expense issues at the federal level. But anyways, the story continues throughout the entire week, and specifically on Tuesday with the revelation that Philip Brent will also be appearing in court next month on a traffic violation. He failed to report an accident that allegedly occurred in Edmonton. They note that the matter is not criminal and it falls under the Alberta Traffic Safety Act. So it was a combination of the Airbnb, the double-dipping meal expenses, and this failed to report accident that resulted in his removal from the UCP caucus. The story dominated the provincial news cycle in Alberta for most of the week until the media and the NDP government focused on our firing line segment, which you'll hear about in just a little bit. The question that should ultimately be asked is, were the stories that were of higher precedence glossed over to cover what amounted to a debt of $192.60? So as we mentioned last week, the Airbnb rental for the Edmonton apartment raises, you know, serious ethical issues for the government as a whole, because there are other government members who are doing it. And a traffic violation is a huge matter for an elected official. But one must ultimately ask themselves what the actual reasoning for this story was to dominate most of the provincial news cycle this week. The United Conservative Party is less than a month old, and a leadership race is underway. And when this race was getting going, there was some speculation that Derek Fildebrandt would run. He set up a PAC, a political action committee, to organize and raise money ahead of a potential leadership bid to focus on the libertarian side of the United Conservative Party. It's been reported that he would have had federal support from Maxime Bernier, who came in second in this year's federal conservative leadership race. So when you put all this together, the timing is a little bit odd for this to come out in the middle of a leadership race. It's widely expected that this info that was released this week on Fildebrandt was sitting for a while and was waiting to be revealed at the right time. All in all, it seems a little bit too convenient to appear within the midst of a leadership race, but the NDP and mainstream media had zero issues covering it, even though it was $192, which, as you said, really isn't much in the whole grand scheme of things, now is it?
Yeah, when you consider how much was being spent on municipal officials here, I mean,
exactly.
$2 million in just 1 year,
that's right.
That's a lot more than not even $200.
Yeah. So there's more to this, as I mentioned, specifically relating to the housing allowances. It's been revealed that 31 of the 63 MLAs allowed to claim housing expenses, those who live outside of Edmonton, claimed the max of $1,930 per month. That's 31 MLAs claiming $1,930 a month, the maximum for housing. What was more shocking is that it didn't even make the TV news cycle, and it was near the end of the Edmonton Journal piece, which you can find in our show notes on the matter here. And what is really mind-boggling is that the NDP was involved in this as well. At least two NDP MLAs from Edmonton and two from Calgary have been claiming expenses for housing. The two from Calgary are Calgary Shaw MLA Graham Suka and Calgary Curry MLA Brian Malkinson. The two from Edmonton each share a home and claim $17,000 per year in living expenses. It's not just these four MLAs, but there are others such as Shay Anderson, who also live about 30 minutes away from Edmonton, that are claiming these housing expenses. So this is ultimately a widespread problem with the way housing expenses are handled in the provincial government when you have individuals from all parties taking part in this. So before we wrap up on this story, we'll talk about the good that has actually come from this, aside from the biased coverage from the mainstream media. So the United Conservative Party is undertaking an internal audit for expenses after this, and it's been revealed that many in the UCP caucus have made errors in their expense claims, but the total for the entire UCP caucus was only $557.30. The most egregious were Don McIntyre at $180 and Dave Rodney at $154. The other seven each had irregularities of under $100. So while Derek Well, the Derek Fildebrandt case is unfortunate and highly hypocritical of the mainstream media to be covering it. The rest of the United Conservative Caucus is undergoing an expense audit and taking steps to ensure that expenses will be reported and expensed properly in the future. So as you can see here, the whole story is kind of shaping up is that Derek Fildebrandt took the fall for what was going on in the entire party regarding the expense issues and for the entire provincial MLAs who are claiming housing. So there's lots of questions that are going to be asked when the parliament resumes this fall.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that Fildebrandt is the only one to take the fall on this one, because he was kind of seen, at least from my perspective outside of Alberta, as kind of a star candidate for the UCP, because he had, you know, ties to Maxime Bernier, and we saw him quite a bit in the Conservative leadership race that just happened a couple months ago, and he had quite a high profile, really, and the fact that he was considering running for leader in the upcoming leadership election is quite a big deal. And the fact that this all came out all at once and forcing him to resign from the UCP caucus, it also raises eyebrows, does it not?
Yeah, like I said, it's a very baffling story, and lots of eyebrows raised over this, particularly in regards to the timing, but also I think the fact that, you know, while the focus is, of course, on Derek Fildebrandt and maybe others, there are, you know, a few pieces near the end of the print media pieces in the Edmonton Journal and whatnot, who are highlighting that the NDP is involved in the housing issues as well. But you don't hear that when you hear this story, you know, in the big, bold headlines on the global news site or in the evening news. You don't hear that. And, I mean, there also have been cases of egregious expense claims on the NDP side as well in the past. So it's something that is an issue on both sides. And this has really become let's just call it a government-based firing line this week for this, even though we do have something kind of related to this in just a little bit. So,
probably even more strange, I think.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think with that, we're going to head on to our Canada piece. And, well, we're going to be looking back on an issue that I think we've developed probably since the beginning of this podcast. And I think when it comes to the issue of immigration and the migrants that are literally walking over the Canada-USA border illegally, it, you know, something certainly that we've talked about at length, and it's kind of hard to talk about it again without retreading, but there have been new numbers on that front, and a few articles have come out recently that highlight the very real problem that Canada is currently experiencing with its immigration. So the number of illegal migrants that have crossed into the border into Quebec in August was actually first broken by the BBC of all news outlets, with a staggering number of over 3,800 in just the first 2 weeks of August alone. This is almost half again as much as the more than 7,500 people that have arrived from January 1st to July 31st. And as we mentioned in previous episodes, warmer weather would cause more to flee the United States and into Canada. And it appears that the international media outlets like CNN, the BBC, and others have picked up on this as well, with mentions that many migrants in Montreal are being held in temporary shelters and in the Montreal Olympic Stadium. And the military is also building a tent village near the major border crossing of St. Bernard de la Colle. And setting up tents, this is something obviously we're quite familiar with. We're pretty good at doing this, said Major Yves Desbien. He's the spokesperson on the ground for the Canadian Armed Forces. Quote, but in terms of these capacities, it is not something we do very often. The BBC article notes that both provincial and federal officials are concerned that misinformation about Canada's refugee program is being propagated through social media, helping fuel the influx. And for misinformation propagated through social media, one only has to look at Justin Trudeau's tweet back in January when this issue was first starting becoming worse, when he said, quote, to those fleeing persecution, terror and war, Canadians will welcome you, regardless of your faith. Diversity is our strength. #welcome to Canada. That tweet, of course, now has almost 800,000 likes and 450,000 retweets. Immigration spokesperson Luis Dumas addressed the false information circulating among Haitians on social media in the United States, namely in a WhatsApp message that says Canada is inviting people to make asylum claims. Quote, "It's not a message from the government of Canada. Strict processes are in place for all people claiming asylum, regardless of how they enter into Canada," he said. The RCMP notes that staggering numbers have entered the country in the recent summer months, but that there are currently no larger security concerns. Quote, "Our officers have to check the identification of each individual to ensure that they do not represent a danger or a threat to the Canadian population. We can assure you that the only law they've broken is entering the country illegally," RCMP spokesperson Claude Castonguay said. CBSA spokesperson Patrick Lafort said that the RCMP is transferring around 200 to 300 asylum claimants per day to the official border crossing at St. Bernard de la Colle. Though that number can fluctuate daily, he said in recent days there have been around 1,000 to 1,200 asylum seekers at the La Colle crossing waiting for their claims to be processed, while underscoring that Canada remains a opening and welcome country to all those seeking asylum. Lafort said crossing the border between entry points is illegal and that there are no free passes into the country. So a majority of those arriving in the current wave are from Haiti and were living legally in the U.S. In May, U.S. President Donald Trump announced that the U.S. would end the program that extended temporary protection from deportation to the Haitian citizens after the devastating 2010 earthquake. However, later in May, the Trump administration reconsidered the decision and extended the deadline another 6 months to allow for better preparation. That protection is due to expire in January 2018, which is probably why a lot of them are coming over in the summer right now.
I'm just going to interject here and say it's a little bit odd to hear the story coming from BBC, CNN, and then see that the RCMP and the Border Services are the ones putting their foot down. But in recent days, the federal government has been oddly quiet on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting how a lot of this quotes from the articles are coming from the CBSA and from the RCMP, and there's a lot of provincial government talk about this, but there's really been not much on the federal government front. Mark Garneau recently announced another batch of immigration officers that are going to be heading to Quebec to help deal with the issue, but I mean, that again is not very much at this point, because the amount of people that are just coming over the border has increased by almost 1,000% since this first started happening. And Quebec's premier, Philippe Couillard, has called the issue a very delicate situation. He said, quote, "It is unfortunate that these very vulnerable people were convinced that admission as a refugee in Canada and here in Quebec would be simple, even automatic. That's not the case at all. There is no guarantee that asylum applicants will be accepted given the strict rules that govern them." So it's kind of interesting how in July and August, the amount of illegal immigrants have come over the border have, you know, sharply increased by quite a bit. And I think when we first talked about this back in February, I think it was, we noted that there would be a lot more people coming by in the summertime when the weather is nicer.
Yep.
And just the amount has come in just the previous couple of months is quite a bit. And there's probably more coming at the end of coming into the end of August here. There were just around 700 in June, but that number went up to about 2,800 or 2,500, I think, in July, and it's now up to 3,800 just in the first 2 weeks. So we might see anywhere up to 7,000 just in the month of August, and that's quite a bit when you have to think about
the size of a small town.
Housing issues, healthcare issues, education for all the children,
safety and security.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many issues that go along with this, And the federal government's sure they're sending more immigration officers, but they're not really saying much else on this. I mean, they've sent the military to create basically tent cities, which is good for temporary, but you certainly don't want that to be staying like that forever. It's certainly not for a long time. And it's just kind of interesting that that's how that's gone. And just to backtrack a bit to before this recent migrant problem, there's also been another article that has come out recently. According to Douglas Todd, who is a writer for the Vancouver Sun, there's also been a new report out of the Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship Canada that officials are pondering over. Todd mentions that with a backlash against the words assimilation and integration, like I mentioned 2 weeks ago with the Manitoba license plate story, officials are now using the words absorptive capacity, which the report defines as a two-way process that encourages adjustment on the part of both the newcomer and the receiving society. I'm not sure about how everyone else feels, but that really sounds like a lot like assimilation to me. But that's besides the point. As Todd writes, the internal report, obtained under an access to information request, shows that the immigration and analysis are worried that the absorptive capacity of Canada is going down. Quote, declining outcomes of recent immigrants have shown that integration is not automatic, says the report, which surveys emerging problems with immigration flows and the pressure it's putting on Canadian sectors. While some Canadians behave as if it's xenophobic to question immigration policy, immigration rates and their results, the sweeping in-house government report titled Evidence-Based Levels and Mix Absorptive Capacity does exactly that. It shows that the integration of immigrants into Canada, despite relative success here compared to most countries, is faltering in regards to housing, jobs, healthcare, education, religious tensions, ethnic enclaves, and transit.
You know, this is something that really didn't get too much coverage after the waves of Syrian refugees came over, is that, you know, there's some rumblings in, you know, areas of Toronto and whatnot that there might have been problems with the integration or absorptive capacity, as we're calling it now, about this. And, you know, when we're having this many come in addition to actual refugees, that's going to be stressing a lot on the system side, but it's also going to be stressing lots of new Canadians who are here legitimately and people who have been here for a long time who have come here legitimately as well, decades ago. So, you know, this needs to be a situation where the goodwill of Canadians and the Canadian systems is not used up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some key points that are in the report are ones that are probably well known to government officials, but haven't really been talked about in the media very much. It mentions that immigrants are struggling to find housing. This isn't really surprising, as housing prices in the largest cities where most immigrants live have been skyrocketing over the past decade. It also mentions that immigrants have difficulties getting health care, which is also not surprising, as the healthcare system as a whole is experiencing system shock with the baby boomers moving through the system. It also mentions that immigrants are not dispersing across the country. Two-thirds of immigrants live in either Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, which is the three largest cities in Canada. So the report says the, quote, absorptive capacity is only being tested in our largest cities. It also mentions that language gaps are expanding. Despite language requirements, it's found that many recent immigrants aren't passing on English or French to their kids, and that 3 in 10 Canadian-born children of immigrants require remedial ESL training, which suggests a lack of language integration in the home among the parents. It also mentions that ethnic enclaves are expanding. Immigrants are settling near others of the same origin or language, which creates enclaves in many cities. I mean, this is something that is happening for many years now. You know, we have like Chinatowns, Little Italies, that sort of thing. It's been something that's been going on in major cities around the world for hundreds of years. But with the recent increase in immigrants, it's actually more pronounced now. And there's actually entire cities where it's mostly made up of visible minorities, such as Richmond with the Chinese population that's there, or in Surrey with the large East Indian population. And it also mentions that tensions exist over religious differences. Quote, religious and cultural accommodations continue to be an issue regarding practices that are deemed in conflict with Canada's institutions, the report says, which names forced marriages and family violence issues as major hurdles. This is something that had been raised a lot in the previous election with the Conservatives, with a barbaric practices tip line that they were talking about. And it turns out this is actually a major issue among recent immigrants who hold a belief system and don't necessarily want to reconcile that with Canadian law.
And of course, if we attempt to talk about this or deal with the problem, someone is end up going to be called racist somewhere along the way.
Yeah. It also mentions that despite trying to be frank about Canada's immigration difficulties, the report actually notes that the country is recognized as a world leader in creating an environment that enables newcomers to settle and become active, productive, and connected citizens. It notes that Canada is ranked third out of the 31 countries that welcome immigrants, and the Migration Integration Policy Index rates only Sweden and Portugal as doing better at absorbing newcomers. Despite Canada's strong ranking, the Immigration Department's report notes another disturbing finding which could have long-term repercussions. Second-generation visible minority immigrants compared to first-generation immigrants are more likely to perceive that they've been the subject to discrimination. Poll results suggest 43% of Canada's second-generation visible minority citizens are convinced they're being treated unfairly, may point to an expanding crack in the dream of cultural integration, which the report says. And that's something that isn't really talked about very much, because there's always the expectation that it's going to be harder for the first-generation immigrants to integrate in the country, and that it's up to the second generation that's born in Canada that are better able to understand the language, better able to understand the culture, grow up through the education system, and become better integrated into Canadian society. But as this report notes, it notes that with the language gaps expanding and the difficulties getting health care and housing, education, it's actually making it a lot more difficult. And it's saying that the second generation are believing themselves to be more discriminated by the system than previous times. And as for coming up with better policies, the report makes it clear that immigration officials are often in a fog about the overall effects of large-scale immigration on Canada, not to mention the impact of international students and temporary foreign workers. There is no, quote, comprehensive stock-taking on how Canadian institutions and cities are adapting to immigrants and other foreign nationals. The knowledge vacuum exists across housing, healthcare, the regional job market, transit, and more. The internal department report, what Todd writes, is in effect a muted cry for help, so those who make immigration policy can stop flying mostly in the dark.
Well, I think we can all agree with that immigration policy should not be made flying in the dark. The question is, will any kind of policy like that, even based on recommendations, be debated in the House before the next election? And what would happen if one of these became an election issue in 2019? Like I said, someone will inevitably get called racist, and it'll be our job to pick it apart and see who's wrong in that case, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, I think when someone cries racism, I don't think there's any winners, really.
That's true.
I think once the arguments have devolved to that point, it means that there's no possible way that you can reconcile the two differences. And at that point, there's not much that can get done. And especially if it's coming into government, you've got the Liberals, who on one hand seem very open to immigration, but they aren't really doing much on this the migrant issue. Then you've got the Conservatives, who have been kind of silent about it recently, haven't they? But they've been trying to make it seem like they're very multicultural, but they're also trying to play both sides of the field on this issue, it almost seems. And The NDP, of course, have noted quite a bit of the illegal migrants, but they're also very welcoming of immigrants as well. So we're going to have to see how this turns out if more people end up coming into August, but it's going to be a huge issue, I think, when Parliament reconvenes in September.
Most definitely. Unless, of course, this report and the idea to do this report just gets swept away and we continue as though nothing has been happening over the summer, even though, quite frankly, it has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, of course, if the government just decided to go with the idea that nothing is wrong and everything is fine. Please look away. There's nothing to see here on this issue because they have done it before and they'll probably do it again.
But of course, that's not the case when the military is setting up tents and people are being housed in an Olympic stadium.
Mm-hmm. And especially not when you got people like you and I here, which will always put light on this issue.
All right, well, we're going to move on to firing line, and this is where the right side gets really bizarre this week. So the headline reads as follows. Ezra Levant's damage control, not enough for UCP leadership hopeful taking on the rebel. So, of course, this is referring to the rebel, Ezra Levant, the United Conservative Party leadership race, in coverage with the horrible events that happened last week in Virginia. So we've already talked about the expense issues of Derek Fildebrandt and what this has led to in the party and the government as a whole. But there's another story this week that the media, in general, all of them, had a field day covering. UCP leadership candidate Doug Schweitzer earlier this week called on other leadership candidates to denounce the Rebel, which is the right-of-center media outlet run by Ezra Levant. The Rebel was, of course, started after Sun News folded a number of years ago and has been largely successful as a private company. Last Saturday, the Rebel had a reporter at the Charlottesville, Virginia protests. Doug Schweitzer then issued a tweet calling the coverage absolutely wrong, quote, tagging both Jason Kenney and Brian Jean, saying that, quote, you can't give them a pass. Schweitzer then accused the Rebel of defending Nazis in its coverage. The very essence of journalism here is to cover events, no matter how reprehensible they might be. There may have been some unprofessional comments issued live via Periscope on Saturday, and the Rebel's correspondent, Faith Goldie, went on an interview with a neo-Nazi podcast, whose name won't be repeated here in order not to give them extra coverage. But the event here in Alberta has been taken grossly out of context. This week, both Brian Jean and Jason Kenney did end up denouncing the Rebel and clarifying that they haven't given interviews or supported the Rebel in what has been quite some time, several months. Brian Jean echoed Doug Schweitzer shortly after his initial tweet, just over an hour after to be precise. Jason Kenney criticized the violence a few hours after it happened via Twitter and explained his relationship with the Rebel by midweek. This should have ultimately ended the story, but it kept getting weirder as the week progressed. NDP House Leader Brian Mason held a news conference to denounce the Rebel and took swipes at both UCP leadership candidates. Brian Mason associated that Brian Jean and Jason Kenney both had, quote, associations with the Rebel, but he did not provide any actual evidence towards what these associations may be. Let us recall previously that Jason Kenney was immigration minister in the Harper government and brought a record number of visible minorities and minorities in general to Canada over his tenure as immigration minister. It's pretty hard to believe that someone who advocated for wide immigration to Canada, bringing in a merit-based immigration system and overall increasing immigration numbers, could be branded as a racist or white supremacist by association, as Brian Mason was inferring. Well, this should have ultimately been the end of the story. Without the Brian Mason news conference, the story just kept progressing and becoming substantially more weird over the entire week. The Rebel was hit by a string of people leaving the organization, including Ottawa correspondent Brian Lilly, contributor Barbara Kay, historical contributor John Robson, and later this week, Faith Goldie was also fired by the Rebel for her appearance on the previously mentioned podcast. For what it's worth, Ezra Levant issued a public memo condemning the racism in Charlottesville and the alt-right earlier this week. The media covered this with their usual vigor, as they don't seem to like what the rebel does or has done in the past, at least here in Alberta. And it was also linked with the ongoing UCP leadership candidates, except Doug Schweitzer. The story continued throughout the week with the revelation that Ezra was being blackmailed by some young men who were previously part of his UK team. They alleged that the finances of the rebel in Canada aren't what they appear to be, and the rebel is pocketing money from its fundraising campaigns. Ezra says that this is not the case. It's ultimately not clear right now who is correct in their assessment, Ezra here in Canada or his former UK team. What's truly bizarre, though, is that this has resulted in media pieces from Canada's media chronicling the debacle with a continued focus on Conservative politicians here in Canada. Of course, at the federal level, Andrew Scheer, for example, and here in Alberta, both Jason Kenney and Brian Jean. To name a few headlines from this week, we have this one from Global. A fight over a four-bedroom house, the rebel media meltdown, and the full recording at the center of the controversy. From the CBC, Ezra Levant's damage control, not enough for UCP leadership hopeful taking on the rebel. From the Globe and Mail, now this is a truly bizarre headline. Vice co-founder Gavin McInnes's path to the far-right frontier. Of course, Gavin McInnes is one of the other commentators at The Rebel. And finally, National Post this weekend put out an 11,000-plus word piece on The Rebel entitled Inside Rebel Media, How Ezra Levant Built an Extreme Media Juggernaut, Became a Major Player in the Far-Right Movement, and Watched it All Begin to Unravel. So while the future of the rebel remains uncertain, what is certain here is that the media has had a field day with the rebel, the UCP leadership race, and the excessive coverage that this provided them this past week.
All those headlines sound like they're coming from your grocery store tabloids, don't they?
Indeed, they do.
Oh my goodness, it's like, I think we've both been following this story pretty well over the past week, and it's just been crazy how each and every day there's been something weirder and weirder about it going on, and you start to wonder, what on earth is true? And it's really tough to sift through all the news articles and all of the different opinions and the crazy headlines and the different accounts from both Ezra and, you know, the other people tied to the case, and it's getting difficult for even you and I to figure out what's true.
Oh, yeah. I'm not even sure what's true with the rebel anymore. But the core point to be made here is that this all started with Doug Schweitzer trying to get Jason Kenney and Brian Jean to denounce, which, I mean, they did. But even after they did, the NDP continued with it. The media continued with it. And, you know, in some ways, this has just been this week the gift that's been kept giving for the media here.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like with the rebel imploding, where does that leave conservatives for right wing news choices? I mean,
exactly.
One would think that the National Post is usually further to the right than the other mainstream.
But an 11,000 word piece.
Yeah, I know, and they've been talking about how it's an extreme media juggernaut. I mean, the rebel isn't that well known. I wouldn't call it a juggernaut by any stretch of the means. I mean, sure, it's successful as a YouTube-based news company and how it has its own site and lots of contributors, but I wouldn't call it like on the extreme politics edge of it. I mean, it's certainly not it's certainly not as far right on the spectrum as a lot of the kinds that you would see in the United States, and just them labeling it far right is just something else entirely. I mean, you go on to the rebel and you see a lot of criticism of Trudeau and Rachel Notley and a lot of other what we could call left-wing politicians, but you don't really see them espousing Nazi ideology or fascism or anything like that. It's just typical right-wing politics. I mean, it's just crazy how the media has just been going on about them
right
on this, and they've just labeled them far right. It's like how we were talking about earlier. It's the first one to call to play the racism card, no one wins. And I think in this case, I don't think anyone is winning.
Yeah, and I mean, the question could ultimately be answered if they read the memo that was put out by the Rebel this week. They would see that the Rebel did ultimately denounce what happened in Charlottesville and dealt with their employees who were involved with that in an appropriate way. But, you know, the media just wasn't having any of it. So, but I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week this week, which is far right. You know, typically in our modern world, politics is classed as either left, center, or right. And then you have far left, far right. And typically we see conservatives right, liberals left, and, you know, some people claim to be centrist and whatnot. And the far right is really a improperly defined term, because in our production of this show, we wanted to do that as word of the week, but there was no real cohesive definition on what far right actually is. So to do this and to get a proper look at this, we have to go back to the time after the French Revolution, in which the French governing body was set up. And inside the French governing body, and even still today in Europe to a large degree, those who do not want change sit on the right side of the house. Those who want change sit on the left side of the house. And that's where the whole political idea of left and right came from, is that leftists were for change and they wanted to change the system, whereas those on the right wanted to conserve what we have. So as we can see over time, right and far right has been co-opted to, almost like you said, become a term just like coining someone as a racist, because there is no real definition of what far right is today. Granted, you can call some folks like white supremacists and Nazis and the alt-right as being really far right, and that they have hateful views and whatnot. But at the same time, it's not really a term in terms of traditional political discourse.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are being labeled as being far right, even though they aren't. They're probably just the regular right wing. But I think using far right is almost like the political version of calling the racist card, because in doing so, it's basically using it as an insult. I mean, you look at the headlines we saw and how it's far right frontier, the far right movement, and, you know, extreme political views and whatnot. It's making it seem like being right wing is almost being demonized, and it's being described as being far right. And of course, when people think of far right, they usually think of Nazis, and they think, well, we fought against them in the war 70 years ago, we should make sure these people don't get into Canada, when in reality there's a lot of people that are just being falsely described as
right.
being far right.
Exactly.
And the media just jumps on this every single time when something like this comes up. And I think it's something that's really topical this week, is to note that white nationalism and white supremacy and neo-Nazism that's taking place in the United States, yeah, that's something that's, that shouldn't happen, I think. And white supremacy, in a sense, is not something that you and I would certainly agree with espousing, because it's not something that in Canada, at least, we do not agree with. I mean, it's, but calling someone far right when they really aren't, I think that's just exacerbating the issue. You know, it's just making it worse, and it's not really solving anything. And I think that's what the problem is with the media, is that they're supposed to report the news, and they're not reporting the news. They're trying to insert their opinions in, and
it's a perpetrated false narrative.
Yeah, and that's exactly why we do this show, is we want to make sure that we cut out the bias, cut out the sensationalism, and just give you what the actual news is, and we'll tell you what we think about it, but we won't try and disguise our opinions as actual news.
Exactly. And this is a very key point to also mention the name of our show, Right Side News. As it's been described before, it does not necessarily mean the political right or the far right. It is simply put the right side of the news to cut out that bias and sensationalism. Mm-hmm. So, Anyways,
being correct or
exactly
being, or being true.
I think that was word of the week number one. So, anyways, that's pretty much our episode for this week. If you guys want more of this, rightsidenews.ca. rightsidenews.ca/iTunes to subscribe to the audio version. We're also on YouTube at rightsidenews.ca/YouTube and on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca. So with that being said, thank you for sharing your time with us, and we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And hopefully next week's news will be less weird, and hopefully there's no more protests, and we'll all be able to live together happily. So with that, we will see you next week.